Support comes from Clipper Vacations, offering getaways on the Clipper Fast Ferry to Victoria, BC. Clipper Ferry and hotel packages from $250 per person. Enjoy historic charm, afternoon tea, and more. Terms and conditions apply. Details and booking at clippervacations.com.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Diana Opong in for Libby Denkman. We're continuing our series of conversations about the issues raised in the new podcast from KUOW and the Seattle Times called Lost Patients. Lost Patients looks at why there are so many severely mentally ill people living on the streets in Washington State and why they're not receiving the care they need. In the final episode of Lost Patients, host Will James and reporter Sydney Brownstone look at recovery and what it looks like for several folks living with mental illness. Will James and Sydney Brownstone are here in the studio with me right now. Hey, welcome. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For much of the series, Lost Patients has explored the churn. This is the term that you use to describe the movement of people between emergency rooms, psychiatric hospitals, jails, prisons, and life on the streets. But this last episode, you're looking at stories of recovery. Why did you choose to wrap up the show this way, Will?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that we didn't want to leave people hopeless. So we wanted people to understand that people really do reach a place of equilibrium with these illnesses. They really can progress. They really can get to a better place. All the people that you hear in this final episode, episode 6, at one point in their lives, they were seriously mentally ill, living on the streets, using substances. They were the sorts of people you might encounter in downtown Seattle and just write off and just feel hopeless. So we wanted to send a message that, like, no, those people, like, there's a next chapter to their story. Like, that is not where everyone's story ends. So that was important, giving people hope. But also, the stories of individual people's recovery from these illnesses have these lessons for all of us, I think, about how we all might recover as a society in our dysfunctional relationships with these illnesses and the ways we fail people. By studying the ways that people have improvised recovery for themselves, by listening to them, we might be able to figure out, like, oh, maybe we can incorporate some of these lessons in what we build that will actually help people get to this place.
And Sydney, I know you wrote a lot of the episodes and helped put a lot of time and effort into helping shape and craft these stories. Would you say that was an important part for you as well?
Absolutely. I think we were really satisfied that we were able to start the podcast with the internal experiences and voices of people who had lived through these psychotic episodes, and then end the podcast with the internal experiences and the voices of people who have actually experienced these types of things. I learned a lot from their stories. One of the things I learned is that we tend to think of an us versus them in terms of serious mental illnesses. Like, there's normal people, neurotypical people, and then there are people who have psychosis and are on the street. But there's actually a spectrum of experiences and altered states that exist, you know, in this gray area between the so-called two camps. And I think the more we embrace that blurriness, the potential for altered states among high-functioning, so-called, or quote-unquote normal or neurotypical people, the more we can better serve everyone.
Yeah, and that's what also makes it complicated, is there is that spectrum. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all. In the final episode of the season, you tell the story of Lou Middleton. Lou is a person who heard voices and for a time lived in the woods trying to run away from those voices. But Lou is lucky in a way. He has a friend who eventually helped convince him to go to the hospital and consent to mental health evaluation. Lou was skeptical about the care at first, but he eventually found stability, a place to live, and a job. What does Lou's story tell you about mental health care in Washington, Sydney?
It says a few things. The first is that connection is really a starting place for healing, and exile or banishment perpetuates the problem. So Lou was able to get into treatment because he maintained a connection with someone kind of in mainstream society. And that relationship gave him the space to find his own healing. And then secondly, the absence of symptoms does not equal recovery. The absence of symptoms does not equal healing. For Lou, it wasn't just hearing voices and saying, I need to get rid of these voices that helped him. It was actually listening to them and trying to understand where they came from that gave him greater insight into his own condition and then allowed him to help other people. I mean, he was the longest serving peer counselor in the state of Washington. And listening to Lou, I mean, I am not someone who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia or bipolar, but listening to Lou, I related a lot with my own mental health struggles. And I think Lou's experience teaches us that people who have these experiences have a lot of wisdom to share.
And well, many of the episodes in Lost Patients tell the stories of people who are experiencing a mental health crisis through the perspective of their family members, in part because, like with the story of Adam Urand, he had passed by the time this was created, so he couldn't tell his story in the traditional sense. But some may say the podcast didn't have enough voices. They needed more voices of those with lived experience sharing their hardships and their victories. And I'm curious to know, how did you decide who you were going to talk to and why? Weren't there more voices from people with lived experience throughout the entire show?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think in the end, it came down to who was willing. These stories of serious mental illness and psychosis are incredibly complicated to tell. Not everybody who lives through psychosis comes out of it in a place where they are able to share that story because they went through something that is psychologically shattering and incredibly difficult to talk to. It may be because their recovery is complicated. They still hear voices. They still experience delusions. And maybe it's difficult to sort of ethically interview someone in that state. So we spent an immense amount of time on this podcast just trying to find people who, number one, had lived through the instability of psychosis, had really gone through it, had been through what a lot of people we see on the streets have been through. Number two, we're in a place where they were able to talk about it and we could interview them ethically about it, where they're able to give consent. And number three, who are willing. The people that you're hearing in this podcast meet all those criteria and displayed immense courage in sharing those stories. And the reason they're courageous is that there's a huge amount of stigma and shame among people who have lived through these things. Sometimes you come out of a psychotic episode really embarrassed by what you said and did during that time, by who you were during that time. You don't recognize yourself, maybe. Or you are worried that being labeled as someone who has been through psychosis will just mark you for the rest of your life as somebody who's dangerous, as somebody who is
unreliable.
Yeah. You know, so we had lots of conversations with people who were sort of interested in talking to us for a while. And then it sort of at some point decided, you know what, I can't do this. And we just had to sort of roll with that and understand that and not push people. We did the best we could with the limitations that our society sort of imposes on people who live these experiences and, you know, may or may not want to share them.
Yeah.
I'll add one more thing. This isn't a podcast just about the behavior of people with serious mental illnesses. It's also about our behavior. When I say our, I mean, I guess, neurotypical people or even the healthcare system. So we wanted to devote a good chunk of the podcast to exploring the ways in which we, society, is a vector for serious mental illness and perpetuates it and creates worse outcomes here in America than in lots of other places. It's a story about people with serious mental illness, yes, but it's also a story about the way that we treat people with serious mental illness and how we fundamentally value human life. I mean, Will and I have talked about this a lot. When you walk down the street in any American city and you pass someone having one of the worst days of their lives in psychosis, because of the way our society is organized, we come across that scene so many times, you can't stop for everyone. You just need to get from point A to point B. And that kind of dual consciousness that you create in tuning out suffering of other people, that diminishes everyone involved. It's not just diminishing for the person going through it. It also diminishes the humanity of the person walking by. One of the points we want to emphasize is that even though this podcast is ostensibly about people with serious mental illness, it's about everyone and the responsibility we all have to our fellow human beings.
Right. It's bigger than just those individual voices. It's the whole system is what I'm hearing you say. And one thing you touched on, Will, and also Sydney, in a lot of the episodes is sort of the involuntary commitment, civil commitment battle. And I'd love to touch base a little bit more on that issue. Over the course of the show, we heard from family members who were desperate for their loved ones to remain in care. Back to the example of Adam Arand, his mother, who pleaded with Western State Hospital to pay attention to the fact that Adam was speaking to himself, hearing voices again. He was talking about the light inside of him. And that was all happening before he was released to the streets and his medicine was being weaned down. In this most recent episode, you followed up with Carolyn Penzoa. Carolyn has dealt with mental illness and substance abuse, and she feels involuntary commitment isn't necessary or a helpful tool for someone in a mental health crisis. How did you think about balancing all the different experiences when discussing involuntary commitment in this series?
This is the most, in some ways, the most complicated and like hot button issue in mental health care right now is like, when and how do we take somebody's rights away, bring them to a hospital against their will, and sometimes medicate them against their will? The place that we landed and what we really wanted to express was the focus, the fixation on that question. Yes, it's important and it's interesting because there's a lot of philosophy like and morals mixed up in that. But also, you can see it as sort of a distraction too. Because the real question is, what happens before and after? Why was that even necessary to begin with? Why did we let somebody fall all the way to the point that they may have been dangerous to themselves or other people or unable to take care of themselves before we started asking these questions? And then once somebody is hospitalized, are we just adding another stop in the churn? Are we releasing them with the support they need to make sure they don't get back to that place where we have to ask these questions? So our goal with the podcast, with the question of involuntary commitment, was sort of to redirect people's attention to like, well, okay, yeah, this is an interesting question, but why aren't we talking more about what comes before and what comes after? Because those are the questions that are going to prevent involuntary commitment to begin with.
Yeah. What about you, Sydney?
I think that's why I really wanted to focus on history and the mental institution Northern State that had closed, because both Will and I were homelessness reporters at one point. And the question we got constantly as homelessness reporters was, didn't homelessness, like the modern era of homelessness, start because of deinstitutionalization? And that question has an implied answer. The implied answer is, wouldn't reinstitutionalization solve this? Wouldn't the expansion of involuntary commitment solve this? And it really annoyed us because we knew it was missing so many things. So I think explaining how we got here is really important to understanding why we are so focused on involuntary commitment as a solution. I mean, we have created a system through decades of policy choices where sometimes, actually most of the time, the only way that people in severe distress can get care is once they become a grave danger to themselves or others, or once they are in jail, which is one of the worst places for someone experiencing a psychotic crisis. There's this temptation to look at involuntary commitment and say, okay, if we just fix or tweak this one thing, if we can get everyone on the same page, we'll be good to go. But the issue is why we funnel so many people into that state of crisis to begin with.
I'm speaking with Sydney Brownstone and Will James of the Lost Patients podcast. When we come back, we'll hear about a date that inspired this podcast. That's after the break here on KOW. You're listening to Soundside. I'm Diana Opong in for Libby Denkman. I'm returning to our conversation about the podcast Lost Patients with host Will James and reporter Sydney Brownstone. The podcast is a collaboration between KUOW and the Seattle Times and looks at why there are so many severely mentally ill people living on the street in Washington State and why they're not receiving the care they need. The final episode is out today, and I asked Will what he wished he could have included in this series.
There's one question over, you know, looking at this whole series as a whole. Like, why don't we have better medications for these serious mental illnesses? If we had better medications that worked more of the time and had fewer side effects, things would be a lot better. And there's a whole story about the incentives in the pharmaceutical industry to research and develop new drugs for diseases like schizophrenia. It is fascinating. It goes way back and gets into capitalism and the incentives we have around healthcare that I hope to explore someday. But it is we didn't really have a good place to put it in this series. That is just a whole storyline that I would have loved to put in there.
What about you, Sydney?
I'd say there are two big ones for me. I think the first is an exploration of the criminal justice system and mental illness, and relatedly race and the way that like blackness in particular is viewed as dangerous and can be treated much differently by some of the same healthcare systems or criminal justice systems that confront mental illness. One of the reasons why we didn't get into it is because we could have done a whole podcast on it. And there are people who have written books on this. And we wanted to use our expertise to kind of supplement that. But the other reason is what Will was talking about earlier. People who have been through this often do not want to talk about it. And maybe it's a limitation of us being the, you know, white storytellers that we are. That said, you know, this is not the end of our reporting on this. We're both working on stories right now that can flesh that out a little bit more. The reason we became obsessed with this in the first place was because of this cemetery at Northern State Hospital, which is an abandoned mental hospital in Washington State. And we went there on a date, actually, and ran into a guy who seemed to be rooting around in the cemetery. And that guy, as it turns out, was trying to identify all of the lost patients in hundreds of unmarked graves in that cemetery. I do wish we could have included his story. His name is John Horn, and the work that he's doing to identify all of these people who have been forgotten by history.
Wow. You guys know each other personally. You don't just work as reporters and you didn't just work on this project. You guys are life partners as well. You're engaged. You're going to get married. What was it like working on such heavy stuff together?
Oh, it was the most natural thing in the world. We met making a podcast years ago called Outsiders about homelessness. And I think the entire time we've known each other, I don't know, we just talk about these things all the time and sort of share ideas and like develop these ideas in conversation with each other. So in some ways, this podcast started out as a way to just be in conversation with each other and sort of sort through some of these ideas that we were seeing in our reporting. Like, it's just sort of how we operate, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also worth saying that when Will and I first started working on a podcast together, I was a total jerk to him because all I knew was that he was some dude with a podcast. And that's like the last thing I wanted to be around. And also, it was about homelessness. It's about this incredibly sensitive subject. And I had this idea like, okay, he's just some guy with a podcast. He's going to want to make trauma porn. And so I sat down with Will in the studio and I basically told him, listen, I'm not going to help you make your stupid podcast about trauma porn. These are my standards. And if you're not down with this, like, count me out. He actually put that tape in the podcast. And then over the next several months of reporting with him, he absolutely earned my trust. I saw the sensitivity with which he reported how he treated his sources. And that trust, even before we were dating, is, I think, the basis of why we work so well together and also just like why we are partners. It's just like I absolutely trust him with anything. I know that he will put humanity and kindness and responsibility to others above all else. And so when that is the foundation of a working relationship, it's easy.
Sydney, you mentioned something about who you guys are as two white people covering this story, that maybe that was a potential barrier. I'd love to just know more about why that is. Like, why do you even think that?
So I have written about people who have died as a result of having a serious mental illness and coming into conflict with the criminal justice system. And I have talked to their families. I mean, this is an ongoing, like, journalistic quandary,
yes,
right?
It is.
Like, what authority do I have as a white person to tell the story of someone with a completely different life experience faithfully and truthfully? And where I come down on it is I have a responsibility to try. The alternative is ignoring those stories. And that would be a dereliction of responsibility on my part. So I have to try. I have to do the best that I can. But I also have to give people the agency and autonomy to make informed decisions about whether they want to participate. And we talked to one family in particular about telling that story. And ultimately, they made the decision that they did not want to participate. And I will respect that decision, you know?
And do you think it was about your race? They thought you aren't the person who could tell this story because you're not a person of color or whatever the criteria was?
I don't know if it was about my race. It could have been about, like, where they were. They could have had a million things going on in their life that didn't make sense for them.
Got it.
But it's always something, you know, that I think about.
Got it.
I am less willing to talk to people who aren't like me about the most traumatizing things that have happened to me. So it's something that I think about. Yeah, I don't want to attribute it to that, but I think we have to acknowledge that we don't know what we don't know, and we have limitations.
Yeah. Do you feel that way at all, Will?
Yeah. The last podcast I worked on before this was about the killing of Manny Ellis in Tacoma, Washington. And in some ways, Manny Ellis could have been a part of this podcast. His story was a lot of things, but one of the things it was a story of a man with schizoaffective disorder who used substances in his search for relief, who did not get the help he needed his entire life. And what was different about Manny's story was the way when he was in crisis, how police reacted to him. In the podcast about Manny Ellis, I was lucky to be part of a team of journalists with all different life experiences and to bring to bear. And all of that led us to feel we were equipped to tell this story. I'm with Sydney. You know, we have a responsibility to try and find the things that are universal and pay attention to the things that are not and try to make others feel comfortable with us as storytellers and let them know where we're coming from. And that's all we can do is work within those limitations and do the best that we can.
Yeah. Do you guys spend any time in the podcast talking about the impact that race and gender play in the role of mental health history?
Well, at Northern State Hospital, we do mention that for a long time, it was very easy to institutionalize your wife if you didn't like her. And the other thing that happened at Northern State Hospital is that a lot of immigrants, people who did not speak English, were institutionalized because people assumed they were crazy when they didn't just speak the language. So, for example, after Northern State was shuttered, researchers and psychologists found that there were people of Chinese or Japanese descent who had been institutionalized for years because they didn't speak English. And that's how at least one local organization specifically catered to the mental health needs and social services for the Asian American community in Seattle got started, because they were responding to the fact that these had been the experiences of people who were institutionalized at Northern State. So there's definitely that, but I think we could do a whole other podcast about the way that
different populations experience the mental health system.
Yes.
Through history.
Totally. There's so much there. There's so much there. If our original idea for this podcast was a history podcast, but that was not selling people. So
one of the eye-opening things, though, looking into the history, is you start to understand how the whole history of our treatment of serious mental illness in this country is braided together with our ideas about who has value.
Right.
The history of eugenics in the United States is deeply, deeply tied into the history of serious mental illness. For a long time, we were literally sterilizing people with serious mental illness so that they couldn't have children and pass on those genes. So embedded in this whole story is, it's whose life has value, who belongs, who is part of our society, and who do we cast out?
The final episode of Lost Patients is out today, but the conversation isn't over. You're planning a live event on Thursday, May 9th at Seattle Central Library. What can folks expect at that event?
Well, we're really lucky to have Esme Jimenez, our partner on this project, join us again. She recently moved to Boston for a new job, but she's coming back. And the reason I'm excited to have Esme is that I really hope to get into some policy at this event. You know, podcasts are a difficult medium in which to discuss like really detailed policy, but just in conversation with people and with Esme's brain and institutional knowledge, we hope to be able to answer people's questions about like, well, what is out there and what is in the works and specifically what's going on, and really satisfy that curiosity that people have.
Host Will James and reporter Sydney Brownstone of the podcast Lost Patients. The sixth and final episode of Lost Patients is available now wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diana.
If you missed the live event, don't worry. We'll air that conversation the following week on Soundside.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.